Welcome to the beginning of Lent. It is another one of those peculiar seasons and observances that you will only find in churches. In congregations that observe the cycles of the church season, as we do more or less, it comes around every year as a reminder. It's a season during which we're encouraged to prepare for the Easter resurrection, as best as one can prepare for resurrection, mind you. And the season of Lent is modeled upon the traditional gospel story that we hear every first Sunday of Lent, that we hear this morning. It's a story that's found in three out of the four biblical gospels, and it's the story of the 40 days that Jesus spent in the desert wilderness just before he began his public ministry. And in many ways, it seems a bit of a peculiar start for a new life. As you heard in this brief version, it's set immediately after this desert time is set immediately after Jesus is baptized in the Jordan by John the Baptizer, immediately after this revelation of the voice from heaven saying, "You are my only begotten child." And as the first step, as the first response to that, what does Jesus do? He does not throw a party. He doesn't hold a press conference with the scribes and Pharisees. Guess what? He doesn't develop his own mission statement. He doesn't create a strategic plan. He doesn't even recruit the first disciples yet. He actually attends to the Spirit first. In Matthew's gospel, it says he's led by the Spirit. In Luke's gospel, it says he is filled with the Spirit. Here in Mark, which actually sounds a little bit more like what I imagine it might have been, he was driven by the Spirit into this desert wilderness. There was some kind of irresistible spiritual force. Jesus could not help but to go into the wilderness. This rocky, dry, arid desert where we're told Jesus fasts and prays for 40 days. Now, Mark's version is the briefest, only two verses, in fact, where Jesus faces temptations. Matthew and Luke are the ones that give us the details and the dialogue that happen in those temptations. And in the desert, he keeps company with wild animals. That's the detail Mark adds. And is ministered to by angels. It's after this, after all of that, Jesus begins this new life. He starts this path of public ministry. So opens Lent. As I've grown older, I have really come to welcome and even treasure Lent more and more. Perhaps it's because it was not something that I grew up with in my childhood church experience. It was not something we observed with any particular care or regularity. But as I mentioned to people who were here on Ash Wednesday, this opening of Lent actually feels like an annual reminder to hit the reset button. You know, over the course of the year, so many things may have accumulated and piled up that every year, as I'm reminded by the desert wilderness of Jesus, I'm reminded that I really can take the time to simplify and prioritize first. This is an annual opportunity to hit a reset button. I don't believe Lent is a depressing time of self-denial and repression, but it's the simplicity of the desert that sets the tone for Lent. Lent is actually one of the oldest traditions in Christianity. It predates even any Christian observance of Christmas. Older than Christmas, Lent. These 40 days before Easter, 40 days minus the Sundays, by the way, were set aside early in the Christian movement as that time where those who wanted to become Christian were to examine themselves, prepare to learn about the new faith before they were baptized on Easter Sunday. And soon it was expanded to include all of the faithful in a time of self-examination and preparation for Easter that was on its way. And Lent, if you recall, is actually the word from ancient Anglo-Saxon for spring. It's the word for spring because at this time of the year, Lent happens in the spring of the Northern Hemisphere, where we have longer days. Lent is lengthening, the lengthening of days. And because it falls at spring, it's a really helpful reminder, especially in an unseasonably warm winter that we've been having, that instead of sacrifice and denial, this early spring is really about the stirring and the signs of new life. Trees and flowers are already budding and blooming, some of them already open. New things are happening during Lent. But I will admit, I'm kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, which is a reminder that new things do not always come without struggle or setback. Lent prepares us for joyful resurrection, but from the very beginning, the timing of the season and the gospel story itself, we're warned that the getting there is not always going to be easy. We may have been awakened by those ahas and glimpses during Epiphany. We have now come down from that spiritual peak of the vision on the Mount of Transfiguration. It's in light of those that now's the season to make the choices about how we will live our daily life. Now, if you were raised in a tradition that observed Lent, you might recall in times past you were asked to give something up, or even more recent trends, encouraged to take on something as an additional spiritual practice to enrich the season. So whether you were encouraged to give something up or take something on, I believe that the point is the same. Preparation takes practice. The more you practice, the better prepared you can become, and practice is the theme that I want us to pay attention to for Lent. Practice, being people of a practice during Lent. Now, whether the term spiritual practice is familiar to you or not, I imagine that you can recall some kind of practicing that you had to do in your life. Be it practicing how to make your letters as a small child, practicing a sport. Notice I had to go to an outside source for a sports reference. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the affirmation. Yes. Be it a musical instrument, some skill that you must have honed or you actively and mindfully repeated in order to get better. I recall that years before I studied singing, I began to learn how to play the piano. I actually started taking piano lessons in the second grade. My two older sisters had been taking piano lessons for a couple of years, and as we all recall the story, some of us better than others, I begged my mother to let me take piano lessons. Now, it wasn't because I necessarily loved the piano or wanted to play, but my sisters got to go every week and do this special something. You know, I was the youngest child, so yeah, there's probably a little bit of that in there. I begged to take piano lessons, and she acquiesced, and I started taking piano lessons a couple of years after my sisters. So all three of us went off to Miss Anna Mae Gase's house and had our weekly piano lessons, one after another. We did homework, read, you know, comic books while the others were taking their lessons. I had begged and begged to take piano lessons, and after a few months, the joy of having to do this special thing quickly wore off, and the begging to take lessons turned into the begging to please let me quit. Please let me quit. I hate it. And I probably whined exactly the same way, but only in a higher... There are very few things in my life that I recall that my parents made me do, other than go to church some Sundays. But they did not let me quit. They refused to let me stop. They kept taking me to piano lessons. And I don't recall that I practiced very well during the week, but sometimes I was cajoled, rarely threatened, I think, into, did you practice for your piano lessons? But after resisting and begging to quit for at least 2 years solid, I remember this mysterious summer where I sat down and started to enjoy playing. Because somehow, over the course of those couple of years, as much as I resisted it, the fact that I repeated it, I gained enough skills that I was suddenly able to play some things that I enjoyed playing. And it was interesting, once I reached that tipping point, practice wasn't always easy, but the pleasure of having learned enough and practiced enough began to kick in. And I had piano lessons through my graduation from high school and even into college. Now, I will not proclaim that I am an excellent pianist. All of the pianists that we hear at our piano are far better than I am. But I am a competent pianist and I'm a really good sight reader. So I am thankful that I practiced, and I'm actually even thankful that my parents didn't let me stop, didn't grant me that, did not surrender to my begging. Now, there may be something like that in your life as well, maybe not at the piano. But just based on that experience for me, there are a couple of observations I want to make about practice. And the first one, I'm going to steal a quote from the religious author Diana Butler Bass. And the first one is, practices are not things that you do when you're good at something. They're practices what you do to become good at something. Practice is not something you do when you're good at something, although you might continue. Practice is what you do to become good at something. You practice because you're not yet as good as you want to be at it. I was bad at the piano. I was painful, I'm sure, to listen to as I practiced. But I got better. Second one, it takes commitment, either inner commitment, and if you don't have the inner commitment, it takes outer accountability. No, we're not going to let you quit. We are not going to let you quit. This is a commitment we will help you fulfill. And the third one, it takes time. Practice is not a quick fix. And only over time do its rewards become evident. So with spiritual practice as a theme, it may be familiar to some of us or unfamiliar to others of us. If you come from a Christian background, you might have a mixed impression or mixed feelings about spiritual practices or disciplines, to use another word. And because it may be less familiar to some, I want to say a few things about what I believe spiritual practice is and what spiritual practice is not. Spiritual practice will not make your problems go away, but it may change your perspective on them. Spiritual practice will not make God love you more. Don't make that mistake, that you earn God's love by practicing. But it may enable you to love God more. Spiritual practice will not turn you into some navel-gazing hermit that has withdrawn from everyone. It will connect you more deeply to the world and others. Spiritual practice is not a magic bullet about getting instant enlightenment, but across time, across tradition, it is proven as a path to grow. It is not about earning your way into heaven, as if such a thing were possible. It is about actively learning to grow in the likeness of Christ. So as I understand it, and as I define it, spiritual practice is any action you habitually enter into with the intention of growing your experience of God. That can mean any number of acts, limitless, in fact. There are as many different ways of practicing as there are people. Inner activities, outer activities, those you do by yourself, those that you do with others. Regular prayer can be spoken or silent. Spiritual reading, weekly worship, by the way, is a practice. Sometimes you do it when you don't want to. That's a practice. Consciously walking, yoga, gazing at beauty, putting yourself in the presence of art or nature, making love with a beloved, washing a dish, preparing a meal, like our food fairies. Any act we habitually enter into with the intention of growing our experience of God. It doesn't guarantee that you'll experience it all the time, because God does not show up at our beck and call, by the way. But to borrow the quote from Henry Nouwen, creates the space in which God can act. It creates the space in which something can happen that we hadn't planned on or counted on. So the dilemma is this. There are as many different practices as there are different people, and there are as many different types of spiritual personalities as there are personality types. There is no one size fits all. And that always makes me suspicious anyway. There are lots of good tips, however, and lots of good tried and true methods. So how might you find the one that fits you? Other than encouraging you to stick around for the next 4 weeks of the series. I believe that the practice that is underneath all spiritual practices is simple: paying attention. And I want to start with introducing a practice that may be familiar to some, but I don't know that it's familiar to most. And that is actually the practice that's on the back of the sheet that's found in your bulletin. It is the examine, which really is a practice of paying attention to what has happened in your life. There is an article written about this and a quote. It's actually, the title of the article is Rummaging for God. Examine is kind of rummaging your memory for where was God when that happened. So I actually want us to practice in the middle of the sermon a spiritual practice. How odd and unusual to do a spiritual practice in church during a sermon. So I encourage you to put the handout down and find yourself in a comfortable seated position. I encourage you to uncross your legs if your legs are crossed. I know who you are. And I encourage you to close your eyes and take a few relaxing breaths. If you fall asleep, your neighbor will wake you up when we're done. And as you are relaxing into that space, I want you to take a moment and recall that you are right now in God's presence. God is already present with you in this moment, even before you begin. And as we begin, we pray that God might offer some enlightenment and some grace as we recall. And I ask you to cast your mind over the last 24 hours. From yesterday morning to this morning. And gently remember, hour by hour or moment by moment, remember what you're grateful for. Were there encounters with people? Were there really beautiful meals? Did you have better rest than usual? Was it more productive? Begin by being grateful to God for those gifts. Are you grateful you woke up? And as you recall this last day, what feelings arise? The delightful feelings, the difficult feelings, painful or joyful. Without judging the feeling, notice which feelings arise. And pay attention. And as you recall this last day and your feelings from those events, select one thing and turn it into a prayer. Is it a prayer of thanks? Is it a prayer of grief? Is it a prayer of joy or remorse? Turn one moment and its feeling into a prayer. Turn your attention now to the day in front of you, be it this afternoon or even tomorrow. What are you anticipating? Are there encounters? Are there appointments? What is on the horizon? And what do you think or feel about what's coming? And whatever that feeling or thought as it arises, make it your prayer. And let us conclude together by reciting the Lord's Prayer in whatever version is most familiar and comfortable. Our Creator, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy dominion come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the dominion and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Amen. The examine is usually given about 15 minutes and often, but does not always, conclude with the Lord's Prayer. It's encouraged for daily use, particularly at the end of a day, as you can well imagine. To rummage for God. God is already acting in your life. It is paying attention to what's happening. Was there some sign in that exercise about some moment that opened you to the holiness, something that points you towards something you can do regularly? There's a spiritual author, James Finney, who says, "Hang out in the neighborhood." If you have had that kind of encounter, hang out in that neighborhood. Daily is best, but pick the regular pattern that can work. I think it's interesting, just as an aside, which deserves its own sermon series, which is difficult when the pastor has more to preach in one sermon than one sermon. Ignatius of Loyola was living at the time when the greatest change in Christianity probably happened, about 500 years ago, the Reformation. Not only did it create huge upheaval and schisms, Diana Butler Bass, another that historian of Christianity, points out that there was a reversal in Christianity that evolved out of that, as more and more weight was placed on the thought and the dogma and believing with the head. The three B's, believing, belonging, and behaving, got reversed from what they had been for the previous 1,500 years of Christianity. So 75% of Christian history, you belonged to a community, you learned its practices, you behaved by being mentored, and then you came to understand and believe. How different is that from traditions that came afterwards and said, you need to sign on the dotted line on this list of dogmas before we will let you in? Part of becoming people of a practice is part of getting things back in the order in which they were intended. We're good at the belonging part, more or less. We are far from perfect, but we welcome people have a sense of belonging. Now, will we practice together? Will we become people of a practice together? Will we open up space where something will happen that can't be counted on? Will we create space in which God will act? Awakenings and epiphanies happen suddenly and randomly. Practice does not. It's a pattern that you choose to create. There is a 12-step saying, keep coming back, it works if you work it. Keep coming back, it works if you work it. There's another one, fake it till you make it. Don't do it just when you feel like doing it. If that were the case, I wouldn't be able to play the piano. There may be days, weeks, months even, that are apparently dry and desert-like. But practice is like tending a dormant seed. You provide the water, the care, but it's God who shows up to give the growth, the new life, the revelation, the resurrection is on its way.